We are resuming the Hartman course, Foundations for Thoughtful Judaism, that we started, what, a year and a half ago? What, a year something ago. We were supposed to resume in the fall, and then October 7th happened, and the whole synagogue calendar got, like, so off kilter and wonky that there was really no room to give it the attention it deserved on my part to prepare and to hold the space and to do the kind of learning that we're used to doing together. And so I'm happy that we're resuming. We last time, for those of you who weren't here, and if you haven't listened to the podcast, you can if you'd like to listen to the podcast, but there are different sections. There are different units of Foundations for a Thoughtful Judaism. And last time what we studied from was peoplehood. So we did several classes from the category of peoplehood. And what we're doing this time is we are going to begin, and we'll see how far we go in this. I have to see how much I like the material from the rest of it. But we're going to begin in the ethics curriculum. So there are three curricula, peoplehood, ethics, and faith. And I thought we would, I thought peoplehood is a good place for Reconstructionists to start, since really, you know, we stress Jewish peoplehood and belonging before believing and all of those things. And then it felt to me like the next place to go with this group was ethics, to really talk about that. We'll see, if we want to go into the faith, unit. We're going to dig into ethics first, though. So we're going to do tonight the first class in the curriculum for ethics. I want to state before we do anything else that it's an interesting time to be teaching the first class on ethics, given the context. And you'll see what I'm talking about as soon as we go there. We did a little bit of this in peoplehood. You know, what does it mean to belong? We did a little bit of this, but I really want to steep us in the Hartman language and the philosophy of there being two kinds of Jewish ethics. One is what we're going to call creation ethics. It's what David Hartman called creation ethics. And the other is covenant ethics, right? So those are the two bases of Jewish ethical conversations. It's the bases that Halacha, Jewish law, is based on, and it was the basis always for adjudication of all kinds of things that came before the Sanhedrin, right, that gets written down in the Mishnah, that gets discussed in the Talmud. It really is the two basic tenets are creation ethics and a covenant ethics, and we're going to unpack what those mean. I want to say from the beginning, I know it's going to bring up stuff given where we are right now. So to preempt, I know y'all, my bright, amazing, wonderful students, to preempt concerns that we're not going to get there, you should have behind your class one, you should have two articles, one by Doniel Hartman and one by Yehuda Kurtzer. The one by Yehuda Kurtzer, I get it. It's 12 pages. I understand. You don't have to read it. I think it's really important for everyone who's going to have a question about, well, if we universally care about, then what about what's happening in Gaza? Okay. So I want us to please not rush there tonight, without having considered first the two ways we think about ethics, and the value of human life. Jewishly, I want us to really steep ourselves in that in good Reconstructionist tradition before we jump to contemporary applications. But I'm giving you Kurtzer, so if you just can't stand it, you can go home tonight and sit with it, or tomorrow morning over coffee, whatever. You can sit with Kurtzer, who discusses it at length, what this moment means. Doniel talks about it some as well, kind of. Doniel's coming from a creation ethics perspective. So you've got pieces in your hand right now that I trust from Hartman scholars to address some of, you know, the massive amounts of things there are to consider, right, in figuring out what to do in this moment and how to hold how we think about things in this moment. So those are for you. I'd like us to hold it till we get at least through creation ethics and covenant ethics, because I just think it's an incomplete conversation if we haven't really steeped and grounded ourselves in the foundations of the tradition. Okay? We good so far? Rebecca, thank you as always for being here to, Rebecca's moderating from her office. So she'll be checking the chat. There she is. She'll bring forward anything that we need, and she's here in KI. So if we have anything we need here, please raise your hand and we'll get Rebecca to attend to it. Thank you as always for making everything run so smoothly. All right, so we're gonna begin with creation ethics. And so you have your sources, and the framing for this class, right, is that there is a parallel in Jewish ethics between what we're calling creation ethics and what we're gonna call covenant ethics. You might think of one as the universal and the other as the particular. So we're gonna look first at Genesis 1, this source from Genesis 1. So would somebody like to read Genesis 1 in the English?
And God created the human being in God's own image. In the image of God did God create it. Male and female created God them. Next one, too.
Mm-hmm.
And God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and reign over the fish of the sea and the fowl of the heavens and over every beast crawling upon the earth.
So this is from Genesis 1. We know Genesis 2 is a different narrative. So anything surprising that comes when you read this just in alone, if you just read this alone as a source, because we know originally it is its own source that gets put with Genesis 2, reading source 1 just as source material for the Jewish people and our sacred text, anything surprise you? Anything come to mind? Mm-hmm. Faye?
So God must have looked male and female.
God what? There must be something about God that is both male and female if they're created in God's image and it says they, right? So anybody wants to think they is such a radical new idea, guess what? And I'm not being sarcastic. Guess what? It originates here. It, Adam, the earthling, was created male and female, right? So they are aware of this, right? So there's lots of reasons they have to not go fully where they might go here because we have Genesis 2, which says we have Adam and then we have Chava, right? So they have to deal with that. We don't, if we just want to kind of look at this text, we don't have to deal right now with Genesis 2. Looking at this, it, Ha-Adam, the earthling, was created male and female, them, they, otam, it's plural in the Hebrew. Okay, Bert, already, go ahead.
can you talk about the word subdue and the translation from the Hebrew? Because okay, that is kind of controversial as to what that means.
Yeah, okay. So first let's look at God created Ha-Adam, the earthling. Remember, earth in Hebrew, what's the word for earth, ground in Hebrew? Adama. So Adam is the product of Adama. So my teacher of blessed memory, Dr. Tikva Frymer-Kensky, would never said Adam or the man, right? She said Adam means the earthling. It's Genesis 1. It's the first reference to creation of a human being. Ha-Adam, the earthling, the thing that's from Adama, right? Zachar u'nekevam bara utam, male and female, God created them. I understand it's a binary. I'm not suggesting the Torah does not understand a binary, that that's what's their frame of reference. Of course it is. I just think it's wonderful that we have an it that is otam. We have an it that is they. I just think it's more complicated than we give the biblical imagination and the rabbinic imagination. It's more complicated and whatever than we tend to say. Okay, so my first question is, so what does it mean that they were created Bitsalmo, in the image of the divine? Already, Faye has suggested, well, it means something about the divine must entail what we understand to be male and female. Minimally, if they are created, this is not Genesis 2, this is Genesis 1. If they are created in the divine image, then minimally, the divine image reflects in some way in us both male and female. So I love that because a lot of people do not know Genesis 1 and they don't understand, right, that originally there was an understanding that both male and female are represented in whatever it means to be created in the image of the divine. All right. So if we don't imagine God as hermaphroditic with a body, what does it mean to be created B'Tselem Elohim in God's image? It can't mean the form, obviously. Bert?
To have the potential to reflect godliness.
So lovely. So this creature is created with the potential to live out what is characteristic of the divine. And one of the words we use to describe what's characteristic of the divine is holiness. All right. So this creature possesses the capacity to reflect godliness in the world.
You got a pass on it.
Huh? Rebecca, will you take care of that, please? Thank you. All right. So I think that's true that it can't mean just the human form, because the rabbis and the biblical tradition don't ascribe a form, a physical form to God. Because there's many metaphors as we've been studying in the Bible. There are many metaphors used for God in the Bible, some of which have no sense of form. Right? Water, air, ruach Elohim, the air, the wind that is God. So there's lots of times there's not an understanding that there's a body of God. So if it's not that, what is it? So Bert is suggesting it might be our capacity to reflect what we consider godly on this plane. Okay. All right.
Well, even the word image doesn't necessarily mean a physical
Correct.
Thing. Have an image, and that is not necessarily what they look like.
Correct. So, and I think that is closer to what Torah actually means.
Okay, go ahead. I might be reading too much into this, but
you can never read too much into a Torah text.
In the image of God, that God created male and female, it sort of implies that both of these entities that God created have an equal capacity to attain holiness, and one is not subservient.
You are exactly correct. You are exactly correct. And by the way, the language that English likes to translate and then people like to infer from there that makes one lesser is the language of helpmeet. Right? God creates Chava in Genesis 2 as a helpmeet to Adam, whatever that old Middle English word means, but it's od there, right? A helper to Adam. And so a lot of people like to read, okay, so Eve is his assistant. She's a helper, so she's lower. But in the Psalms, we get Esainai El Harim Me'ayin Yavo Ezri. I lift my eyes to the hills from whence comes my help. Same word. And in that case, who are we talking about? God. So helper does not mean, if we look at biblical texts, it does not mean assistant. Unless we would be chutzpahdik enough to say the psalmist is saying God is my assistant. What we're saying is God is my ozer, just like Chava is an ozer to Adam, meaning coming from a position of strength to help someone who's not in that position, who needs them to help them because they are in a stronger position. So actually the Hebrew text seems to suggest equality. And she is an ezer, a helper, kenegdo, over and against him. There is nothing that indicates the female is any lesser in any of our foundation mythical language.
Could that be translated partner? The way you're describing it, it sounds more like a partner than someone who's subservient.
Yeah, I'm just not sure. Yes. Yes. If we see partner in all its complexities, right? I'm not sure it's always agreeing. I'm not sure it's always right. You know, it's like Ezer Kenegdo. She is facing him. She is an equal. Sometimes those are contenders. Sometimes those are chevruta partners arguing. Sometimes those are partners who are in sync. Sometimes those are wrestlers with each other. You know, so I just, as long as we hold partner with all the complexities that might mean, then yes, I think that's a decent translation. Lori?
Are we supposed to assume that it was just a single human that's created? It's a auto, so it's like singular. You know, I'm jumping 5 steps ahead in terms of ethics, the idea that we're all descended from a single original human.
So
the idea that there is just a single human here that's being created.
So we don't know. The rabbis have lots of creative things they do to harmonize oto and otam. So Lori's correct to point out in the Hebrew, God creates ha'adam, the earthling, in God's image. In God's image, bara oto, God created it. So that's singular. Zachar u'nekeva, male and female, bara otam, God created them. So we get both it and them. So the rabbis have to deal with that as well. So like one interpretation is God creates a male and female creature and then decides this is not how it should be, that there's a singular creature only. It's supposed to start singular, and we'll see why. But then God splits it in half. And now there is Zachar and Nekeva, Otam. God creates them. So that's one of the, but this is the kind of imagination the rabbis have to bring to a text that isn't clear. Is it a single being? Is it humanity? Is Oto it? And two expressions of humanity are Zachar and Nekeva? We don't know. Linda?
The fact that the two were created and what we've been hearing or talking about or saying right now, equally, there's nothing that points to subservient between man, male, and female.
Correct.
So as we go along through all of this stuff, I don't know, it may change. I haven't read this yet, so.
Right. So I think it's important for us to stay with what the tradition understands as how it's supposed to be, right? How it gets complicated later is like, right, beyond the purview of this class. But we can bring it up when we want to talk about ethics, you know, anytime you want. All right. So Bert asked me to talk about the kivshuha, the Hebrew word, and conquer it, meaning the earth. I think what it means is we are dealing with a text that is written by people who already control the earth. This text is written by people who already are Homo sapiens, right? And again, I'm not being sarcastic or smart. Homo sapiens is writing this story. Homo sapiens is the top of the food chain. Homo sapiens has conquered every other creature on the earth. So I think it's really just reflecting that the way it is the way the creator meant it to be. Right? That human beings were the top of the food chain. Anyone who's like of the Jurassic Park experience or Alien, you know, on the ship knows that it might not have been that way, right? It could have been because we're actually pretty fragile when you come to think of it, how we're born helpless and how we need each other. We need language to be able to communicate what to do when something big comes because we're not strong enough to fight it. So it was not necessarily true that that would be evident from the get-go. Toru seems to be suggesting that's how it's supposed to be. That we have control over, right, the rest of the creatures and the rest of the earth. Torah could not have imagined that we had the ability to eradicate other species or alter weather patterns that would eradicate other species. That is not what Torah means, right? The people who wrote these myths originally, which is even before Torah, who imagined the world that like could not have imagined a world in which human beings conquered the earth, meaning completely brought it into a place where it's affected by every decision we make. Yeah. All right. So what does this mean? So let me just check. I'm doing everything Hartman says I'm supposed to do. So Hartman says, by giving human beings a unique connection to God at exactly the moment they are being created, the Torah suggests that they are unique and universal human characteristics, which stem from humanity's special connection to God. So this is universal. This is every human being, right? Is reflective of the divine image. Every human being, this applies to every single human being. In Jewish thought, the universal, inherent, unalienable, extremely high value of human life is rooted in the idea that all human beings are created in the divine image. This notion becomes Jewish language for talking about the inherent value of all human life. There's no distinction here. As a result, David Hartman referred to those Jewish ethical obligations that are owed to all human beings as creation ethics. Jewish ethics is built on an assumption that the characterization of human beings as created in the divine image implies that certain kinds of treatment of human beings are unacceptable, perhaps because they hurt or disrespect God through hurting or disrespecting that which is in God's image. One of the places we see this most fundamentally in Jewish tradition is all of the rites and rituals and halacha around death. All of the things we associate with, and I'm not talking about mourning, I'm talking about death and burial, are all based in this. That because the human being is created in the divine image, it is an insult to the divine image for a corpse, a human body, to be left in such a state that it could start to deteriorate, it could decompose at all. That is a desecration of the divine image, hence the rush to burial within 24 hours. This is the basis of why we don't burn bodies in a funeral pyre, because it was considered a destruction of the divine image. So even when the soul is gone, which I also love about our tradition, meaning the body itself is considered a sacred reflection of divinity. It doesn't mean God has a body, but it means something about the way we are built, this miraculous human body. And those of y'all who are doctory types know even more than we do how miraculous it is that we don't have to think about breathing. We don't have to think about blinking. We don't think about the heartbeat, right? All of these things, the Kagans, all y'all, like, it is a remarkable system. And our tradition has always appreciated that. So even when it's no longer considered as being animated by the soul or the spirit, however you want to talk about it, the body itself was still considered to be something that you don't desecrate. This is the origin of tattoos. This is the origin of all the stuff that gets all crazy. The origin is actually a beautiful origin. You don't permanently alter and change if you don't have to, if you need a surgery to save your life, obviously. But you don't voluntarily alter the reflected image of the divine that is every human being. We don't have to agree with it, but I'm just saying it comes from an actually great place that did not buy the Western split between the idea, which is also the ideal, and the material, which is always imperfect. Judaism did not buy the split of Aristotle and Plato and all Western thinking. We never bought it. We precede it, and we never bought it. That the material, the physical, is also beautiful and holy and expressive of the ideal, which is the divine. So let's look at source number two. Somebody want to read source number two in the English?
And surely your blood, your lives will I require. From every beast will I require it. And from human being, even from every person's fellow, will I require the life of the human being. One who sheds a person's blood by human being shall their blood be shed. For in the divine image did God make the human being.
Okay. So what we get in this, and the folks who put this curriculum together set this in the context of us being allowed to eat meat. So you're allowed to kill things and eat them. You are not allowed to kill human beings. There is a difference between the human being vis-a-vis killing and other living things. I would need to ask them further where that comes from, that they're setting in that context. I'm not really clear, but I have to go check it. But in any case, it is true that we are allowed to, according to Jewish tradition, to kill animals and eat them. We're not allowed to be cruel to animals. This is where thou shalt not see the kid in its mother's milk comes from, presuming that was happening in neighboring cultures, probably a fertility rite of some kind, cooking a fetal thing in its mother's. Yeah. So like you can kill and eat something, but there's like a limit. You're not allowed to shoo a mother bird away and take her eggs. You have to wait till she's gone and then get up the tree fast. hoping she doesn't come back while you're there. So, so there's a, there's an understanding that you can kill things and eat them, but you cannot be like in you, there's a limit. You shouldn't be cruel. And we could have a whole discussion about why is that ethical? Bert Kleinman is itching to go there. I know. So here we get that there's something different though about human life, that anything that takes human life, whether it's an animal or it's another human, that life is forfeit. Of course, if it's an ox that has gored a human being, so a dog that bites, it's on the owner, right? The responsibility is not yet the ox, right? It's on the owner. But if the ox keeps doing it, then there's a problem with the ox or a problem with the owner, like fixing the fences. So
is there any distinction there, though, probably a silly question, but between a domesticated dog, for example, and a wild ox, in that the ox, or, you know, gorging a human might just be in its nature. It obviously doesn't know the difference, not necessarily that a dog does, but a dog is living in a home with owners.
So oxen were domesticated. All oxen that we would be talking about are domesticated. But I don't know that there is a distinction for the biblical law code, nor for, I don't know about rabbinic. Rabbinic seems to focus on the owner, right? Did the owner know this ox has gored before? And if so, then that owner needed to take measures that are reasonable. It's like putting our laws about putting a fence around a swimming pool, right? It's like, it's on the owner to make sure that no toddler can fall in that pool and drown. All right, so one who sheds a person's blood by human being, shall their blood be shed? For in the divine image did God make the human being. So there is something here, obviously, about deterrence, right? So as bad as it is, and I know some people are going to argue, well, if you're not supposed to take a human life, how come the punishment is taking a human life? Obviously, this is about deterrence. I believe all capital punishment, you know, is really about deterrence. Is there some sense of vengeance, revenge? Sure. In cultures where you kill a member of my family, I get to kill a member of yours, for sure. In a court system of Jewish law, it seems less about that because the judges didn't lose anybody, right? It's about creating a society in which we understand the value of human life is so high that if you take a human life, your life is forfeit.
So Judaism believes in capital punishment?
Yes. And now wait.
No. So,
it's very hard to say ever. Judaism believes in. Biblically, yes. There is definitely an understanding that capital punishment is part of the justice system. Same in rabbinic law, same in the United States. Now, are you going to say America believes in capital punishment?
All Americans.
Okay. So not all Jews. Not all of Judaism believes in capital punishment. There are many Jews today who are very involved. Rabbi Rubin was one of them in working against the death penalty, right? So, but if you look biblically and rabbinically, yes, capital punishment is appropriate in some cases, as it is in the United States today for treason. Remember, please, that early Israel was a theocracy. There was no difference between betraying God's law and treason. If it's a theocracy, God is the highest power in the land. And so any offense against God's law is treason. I know we are so American that like shocks us and it takes us a minute, but that's what it was. So as long as we say as Americans, treason, oh yeah, punishable by death. We can argue about it, but it's understandable. But you know, nah, nah, nah. But now we're even and ends, and now we understand. Okay, fine. But it's not like we go, oh my God, something's punishable in America by death. Like, you know, we have an understanding that there are some things that our culture has decided are heinous enough that they are punishable by death. Same in biblical tradition, same in halakhic decision. The rabbis made it very, 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 very difficult
right.
to put someone to death. If you catch someone with a smoking gun standing over a corpse, you cannot kill them. No, you cannot find them guilty. There have to be two witnesses who saw the person intentionally pick up the gun, intentionally aim it, and intentionally shoot the person. Right. So when I say it was present under halacha, they also made it so difficult that it was very hard to do. Okay, Bert, were you trying to say something?
I was going to say that point, but I was going to add that isn't a capital punishment not legal in Israel, but they made an exception for Eichmann. And I'm sure would have made it for Hitler.
Yeah. I hope they would have made it for Hitler, but okay. All right. So what I don't want to get into, but is a distinction in biblical law and rabbinic law, halacha, is the difference between killing and murder. This is about murder. This is not about any kind of killing. This is about murder. So to intentionally take a human life, to just decide I'm going to kill another human being just because, is, everyone agrees, not okay and punishable by death. Yes.
But how do you reconcile the killing of a murderer, the execution of a murderer, with the fact that the murderer also is in God's image? And if you're not permitted to desecrate a corpse, you know, how can you deliberately terminate the life of someone else who is greater than God's image, no matter what you think about?
So what are you saying? It is a conundrum. I think it's paradoxical, and yet it seems there was enough of a belief that the termination of the divine image had to have the ultimate cost. It had to be that serious that, yes, you eliminate the murderer from the society, from the community, and the only way to do that is death. Exile is not good enough, apparently, for biblical law. And so that, I think, is still kind of the conundrum of the death penalty at all, right? Is we use it as a deterrent and to say that crime is so awful that you forfeit your life if you commit it. Like, but then you said the crime was so awful, but you're going to perpetrate the same crime. So there seems to be an understanding that if someone does certain things, then it warrants a response that one would see as completely counterintuitive, because there's no explanation, right? Your question is not answered. And so this is how we have Jews who are on either side of the death penalty conversation. Jews who say, wait a minute, right? If it's the divine image, how can you get, so is it more respectful of the divine image to let it rot in prison behind bars? I don't know. But this is the conversation. This has always been part of the legal code of civilizations, is to try to live with that paradox of, if murder is the worst thing you can do, then what is the worst punishment, right, that you could incur, forfeiting your own life? But it doesn't make, it's not logical. It doesn't make logical sense. And it's never explained in a logical way.
In sentence five, if you take out the part about every beast, you can eat me. The rest of that, surely your blood of your life shall I require from you and me, and from every person's fellow will I require the life of you. Is that what that implies, that there are circumstances where you have to forfeit?
Yes. 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 And that's how they explain it, by the way. That's how the biblical world explains it. This is God's law. God gets to decide what happens to God's image, right? If you believe this is divine in origin, then your conundrum is solved. It's not a conundrum. God says, don't do anything to take away from my image unless and until one of them kills another human being, then
that's another way of attacking God's image. And maybe the idea is that by killing something created in God's image, you lost your own divinity.
Interesting. I think there's definitely a level of that, right? You have now, I love that language though. You have now so desecrated God's image by using that image to perpetrate this, you have forfeited the right to
degraded yourself, maybe,
so that you have forfeited the right to not have that image degraded by you right. being killed. I love that thinking, Mary. I love that. It's very rabbinic.
It's still a paradox. I can see that argument being
made. Yeah. So and again, for them, it originates with God, who says, "I think that, you know, I get to call what's my image and what's not, right?" And if it gets to the point where you do this, you are no longer protected by.
Right.
You are in my image, and therefore, it's very rabbinic. It's a very rabbinic way to think about it. Where are we going? Oh, yeah. I was worried we weren't going to have enough material for class tonight, so I printed the second class just in case, but good. We're doing good. We're juice. Okay. This is good. So a suggested discussion question, like the statement in the Declaration of Independence about the inalienable rights endowed to people by their creator. This, you don't have this. The Bible discusses in the teacher's version. The Bible describes the responsibilities owed to all human beings as related to God. Why should God be important in a discussion about ethics? Do creation ethics require a high or low level of obligation towards others? So part of the Hartman question is, why, if we're saying what's right or wrong to do to other human beings, what does it mean to bring God into it? Like, is that helpful? Is it not helpful? Particularly as progressive Jews, is it helpful to say murder has its own category because every human being is created in the divine image? And this is just for your opinion. There's no right or wrong about this. Is it helpful? Is it not helpful? Yes, Bert.
Helpful. Helpful. Okay. I vote for helpful. I think, and part of the question is, and I had this discussion in a Hevruta session that I did with somebody else for a while, is ethics just kind of whatever people decide? Or is there, if you want, a source beyond us? Clearly, the Jewish tradition believes there's a source beyond us, and it's unprovable. But if you ask me, do I think it's better that way? I would say the answer is yes, although it's very difficult to figure out what that is. Okay, and what that means. But the Jewish tradition, I think, clearly has a sense that there is something beyond human beings, and part of our task in life is to figure out what that means. And that's different from if we decide all Jews should die, let's just kill everybody and that's fine.
All right.
Or so Christians or blacks or whatever.
Oh, here you go. Okay. So yeah, that's where I want to push back is, if that's true, what about the people who say, I have a God and my God tells me I need to kill all y'all?
No, I don't have an answer to that. I don't have an answer to that. Well, but is that different from just saying, well, everybody in our town believes that we should go kill the witches, so let's kill the witches.
But the folks who were running the church said, God says we have to kill the witches.
Yeah. No.
That's in Torah, by the way.
it is a conundrum. I don't have the answer, but I do believe that as the snow falls from the sky, as it says in one of the Psalms, that there are ethics that are larger than humans, and that part of what we try and do is tap into that. Or as someone said, there are many roads to the top of the mountain. But yes, you're right. There are people who say, God told me that all fill in the blanks should die, and so I'm going to kill them all. And there are people who don't believe in God who say, we should kill all the fill in the blanks.
Yep.
So it's a choice. Mm-hmm. I choose to believe there's something divine. That's just a choice. No proof.
Lori?
I think that the ethics does originate from a sense of, like, I mean, you know, anthropology better than me, but I think that pretty much universally there, you know, across cultures, there will be a prohibition against murder, right? So there's some sense of that, that there is a sanctity to human life that you can't, you know. So is that just, I'm not sure where I'm going here. I think
what the examples that you're talking about is when the sense of who the person breaks down. So if you say every human being on the planet is created in God's image, therefore you can't kill anyone, that's very different than if you start saying our group is the only one for whom we need to worry about not killing and who we see as worthy and who we see as sanctified. And the others, we don't see them the same as ourselves. So I think religious traditions tend to say, you know, the spiritual in me sees whatever, you know, but namaste. I see myself in you. And I think that that's very prominent.
Namaste is I see the divine in you.
The divine in you, right. So I think what I'm saying is that if this is the origin, the Genesis ethics is the origin of treating everybody like they're in the image of God, where that broke down is when human beings started to become otherized from each other.
Okay, so I want to distinguish between otherized, meaning they're a different tribe, they're not us. I want to distinguish between that and non-human, less than human, because I don't think Judaism ever went there.
Or did other cultures?
Well, I'm not as interested in other cultures. I mean, I am, but not for the purpose of these discussions, because I think that that's a different thing. Saying there's us and others, that is a category within Judaism. Mm-hmm. And even within American civilization that we see as so enlightened, used to. The idea that therefore those people are less human because they're other. Those are two different things. I just want to be clear about that.
But both can be used as justification.
100%. And we use the one. And covenant ethics is going to argue that's okay. That's different from saying inherently they are less human. That move other cultures made, Judaism never did. Never.
Yes.
Why did you use the word helpful or not helpful in asking a question? Because I would disagree with Bert and say it's not helpful because this is something between human beings. And that's why we theoretically have a separation of church and state so that it doesn't cloud facts of the issue.
So, but all ethical codes originate with some understanding. It's a question of which one. So you're saying religion could cloud the issue of deciding in America what's ethical. But then what's the source of Americans' ethics? Well, what's the source of the absolute rightness of our ethics? Our principles, where does it come from?
It doesn't come from religion.
Okay, so where does it come from?
It comes from human beings. It comes from.
Okay, and that's somehow better? Like, so do you see what I'm saying? That
humans have to live with humans. Humans don't.
Right, but you're saying, by definition, religion and the source of ethics being grounded in God somehow fogs the conversation among humans about what's ethical. What I'm saying is, what's to say to people who founded America and its understanding of what basic ethics are, is it cloudy by the fact that they got raised, you know, as slaveholders? They got raised, you know, so... You're saying only, and I'm not trying to, no. I'm just saying I want to flesh it out. So, it isn't only divinity that can cause cloudiness around the clarity that you suggest is needed for some kind of agreement between humans about how to behave and how not to behave. As an anthropologist, I am very clear that as much human stuff clouds our ability to see that as anybody claiming anything about God. They're equally messy, and it's like Vaseline on the glasses in both cases. That's why I ask, is it helpful? Bert says it's helpful, because I'm not going to ask, is it true? Because I don't know where that conversation goes. Is it true that it's rooted in ethics? Right. You know, like, so you're right. So the Hartman question is, right, that why should God be important to this conversation at all? To Stephen's point, why bring God into this at all?
It makes it something bigger than humanity. It's something that we all should answer to.
So that's what Bert is saying. So then to argue Stephen's side, well, who decides what God said? are those fundamental ethical values. But I'd ask the same thing about human beings who want to tell you what a council that wants to tell you, because we all have to live together. Here are the fundamentals. Here's what's right and here's what's wrong. So I think that's why I always feel like, is it helpful to root some of what we're talking about in something bigger than humanity? Or do we just go, humans are messy and they all come from their perspectives and they all come from their preferences and they all come from how they were raised and they're all ethnocentric and they're all going to act out of this is right and this is wrong by how I was raised, or because I'm rebelling against how I was raised. Right? I'm starting to watch Napoleon. And like, it just dawned on me. I don't know how it did not just dawn on me. I lived with a history teacher for 12 years. It just dawned on me that the French Revolution that he was a part of, fighting against aristocracy and against royalty having all the power, this guy becomes emperor.
Exactly.
Like, wait a minute. Exactly. Wait a minute. For the first time, I was just like, wait. Like, I really got, and so it's like, oh, yeah, so he was part of the French Revolution, fighting against the control of blah, 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 blah. Guess what happened? Guess what happened? You know, so just saying. All right. I want to hear somebody who hasn't spoken first, then Bert, we'll hear from you. Go ahead.
Perhaps a benefit of the ethical standards being rooted in God, something larger than us, is that it encourages a communal acceptance of a particular ethical standard rather than it leaving it up to every individual to go their own separate ways, coming up with their own ethical views, and that we have to find some way as a community to join together in order to have those ethical standards prevail.
Okay, lovely. So what I hear you saying is that it increases the likelihood of buy-in. Right, because we have a Supreme Court to tell us what's like, yeah, right? So we have a Supreme Court. We have people to tell us. It's not like if you don't root it in God, we have no authority. But I hear you saying if it's rooted in God, then you might have buy-in from the people who think the Supreme Court are doing God's will. And there are lots of those people, right, Bert? So I agree. Good. I agree that that's a great, or it is a very powerful and always has been a very powerful motivator to have people buy into, okay, I agree that's right and wrong because the authority is God. It's not the Supreme Court, right? The Supreme Court is interpreting the will of God, which we know because we can all study it. I agree. I think it increases buy-in, whether we believe it or not, right? So, Bert?
Yeah, I was just going to say, for me, it's more about where do I look for ethical guidance? And there's been a 2,000-year-old Jewish discussion about ethical guidance, and it's in my kishkas. And so, is it true? Is it not true? A lot of people, you know, like, should I lie? Should I not lie? What about this situation? Are all brides beautiful? Blah, blah, I mean, and so, beyond God, I would say I look to what Rabbi Renner used to call the Jewish enterprise, and that is a 2,000 years of discussion. And in that discussion of which I am a part, I find guidance. Is it true with a capital T? I don't know.
All right. So I think that's a great place to shift on to the next source is I, too, believe an important place to look is the Jewish conversation about what's right and what's wrong. As Mordechai Kaplan would say, the past has a vote, not a veto. But if we're not educated voters, it's chutzpah dick to turn in a ballot. Okay, I admit I call someone to tell me who city council and who for what. Okay, I admit it. But I trust her authority in being fluent with, right, what's going on. Like on my own, I don't know. But looking at the tradition is how we Jews, just as Bert so eloquently said, it's how we do find authority, at least to begin framing the conversation, right? About where are our ethics? What do they mean? What do we mean when we say all human beings, right? You know, whatever it is, like, and I too feel like I'm very tempted to root ethical value, the ultimate ethical values in something bigger, okay?
I started watching Shogun last.
Ah, it's amazing.
Right?
Yes.
There, the higher good is you kill yourself.
Dishonor.
honor yourself, which that's defaming the body, right?
Right. So that's why I want to root our conversations in Jewish tradition, because I buy into that, you know, it's holy roller, I'll admit it. I buy into the framework that says, no, honor is not more important than a human life, right? That's why I don't look to another culture's basics. When you're starting with the basics, what are the basics? I don't look to another culture. I look to ours because I like it. And maybe it's because I am so influenced by my tradition that I favor it. But I like starting from a place of we're all created in a way that means our life is not cheap, whether it's by honor, whether it's by, you know, wealth, whether it's by beauty, whether it's by all the standards that people have used to lower one and raise the other. Judaism says you can't do that. You don't get to do that. Male and female, they were created and boom, like it is everybody. We all descended from Adam and Chava. Every human being descends from Adam and Eve. That is a basic tenet of Judaism. And it's not just a, okay, there was how you explain how people got here. That's not the point. They could have picked any explanation. The explanation we have is two people, meaning we're all descended from them. And we're going to get there. Okay. Right? Oh, not yet. Okay, we're going to get there. Oh, my gosh. I have to hurry. Ah! Okay. So did it print 7 to 8 was the time? Because we used to be 7 to 8:30. Okay, so like 7 to 8, we can barely like – okay. And I won't keep you much longer, but I do want to get to these two texts. All right. Let's do shorter on source 3. We can discuss it at another time maybe. I really do want to get to Mishnah Sanhedrin, which goes exactly to what I was just starting to say. All right. Source 3, not to say it's not important, the question. You shall not deliver to one's enslaver a slave who was saved from their enslaver with you. They shall dwell with you among you in the place which they shall choose within one of your dwelling places where it is good for them. You shall not wrong them. So this text is suggesting, not suggesting, this text states that in creation ethics, more than just the bare minimum of not killing someone, we also have other obligations. We don't have to talk for long about whether or not we agree with this one. I just want to give you that Hartman is bringing forward the idea that beyond just not eliminating them, you also have obligations to people because they're created in the divine image. One is if they escape their slaveholder, you don't return a fugitive slave. Now, we could spend a long time talking about what do you do with that in the context of a culture that owns slaves? That's another conversation. The reason for bringing this text forward, and we've had that conversation in Torah study. I'm happy to have it again, but not now. So text 3 is suggesting that beyond just not killing people, we have other ethical obligations, right, to them. And one of the most basic ones being not to return them to where you know there's going to be massive repercussions for doing that.
Them is not just other people in your tribe. It's anybody.
Correct. Thank you for pointing that out. Yes. Bruce, you're looking like you're itching to say something. You swear? Okay. All right. Mishnah Sanhedrin. So, which goes into the idea of capital punishment. All right. So Mishnah, remember, codified around the year 200 CE, in Israel. The Mishnah goes over, the judicial, in this case, procedure for capital crimes, and is really addressing the seriousness of capital punishment as a form of punishment. All right. How did they admonish witnesses in capital cases? So remember I told you, you can't kill someone unless you have two witnesses to the crime. How did they admonish witnesses in capital cases? So why did it begin with the question, how did they admonish? Because what do we need to know first? That they did. Oh, thank you for the lawyer. I love that. I love having lawyers in a conversation about Mishnah. The reason it says, how did they admonish is first you need to know, they admonished witnesses. They brought them in and admonished them saying, perhaps you will say something that is only a supposition or hearsay or secondhand or even from a trustworthy person. or perhaps you do not know that we shall check you with examination and inquiry. All right, so what we know of is they tell the witnesses very clearly, can't be hearsay, it can't be secondhand, it can't be because you heard it from the most trustworthy person all of us would say is the most trustworthy person in the world. It doesn't matter. Also, let them know, right, that we're going to check you with examination and inquiry, meaning if you're lying, we will find out. We will make sure you are not committing perjury. Know, moreover, that capital cases are not like monetary cases. In monetary cases, a person may pay money and so make atonement, meaning if you actually testified on hearsay and not on witnessing, and it's later found out, you can be fined to make atonement for the fact that you, right, didn't actually see what went down. But in capital cases, the witness is answerable for the blood of who is wrongfully condemned and the blood of their would-be descendants to the end of the world. So you're not killing only by your testimony somebody. You're also eliminating every descendant they would ever have. For so we have found it with Cain that murdered his brother. So, of course, always the mission is going to go to a verse from Torah. If they can, always they're going to read it back into Torah, right? Because that is the divine revelation. So they're always going to try to base it in Torah. Just like lawyers today always want to base it in the Constitution. For so we have found it in the Constitution where Cain murdered Abel. The bloods, plural, of your brother cry out. It doesn't say the blood of your brother, but rather the bloods of your brother, meaning his blood and the blood of his descendants. Another saying is the bloods of your brother, that his blood was cast over trees and stones, meaning it's just horrific to slay somebody. It's just, but this is, a lot of people say this is a later gloss on the text because it doesn't really seem to say much. And then nobody says why that's such a terrible thing.
Other consequences, right?
I'm not sure what the consequences for the trees and stones are.
Just that there's blood on
it. It's
change them forever, maybe.
It spreads. Okay. Yeah. Another saying is the bloods of your brother, that his blood was, therefore humanity was created in the world first as an individual to teach that if any person has caused a single life to perish, and of course, this is the Mishnah, so it's talking about from Israel, because that's the only place we have control. Before 200, like if you're talking about biblical Israel, that's the only place we have controls in Israel. And the only place they had control in 200 was in the Jewish community. So halacha, who's going to look to this, the only authority they had was over Jews, right? The rabbis in the rabbinic court had no authority over non-Jews. They are deemed by scripture as if they had caused a whole world to perish. And anyone who saves a single soul from Israel, they are deemed by scripture as if they had saved a whole world. So that is why there is Oto. God creates it. Because then you understand, had that one person, Ha'adam, been killed, the whole world of people would have perished. That's why God creates singly. Okay?
No, it's in the Quran too that. A passage very similar to that.
That if you take one life, it's as if you've taken the whole world.
You save the whole world.
There you go. And they were not ignorant of Jewish texts.
Yeah.
Right? Early Islam was not ignorant of these texts at all. Again, a single person was created for the sake of peace among humankind, that one should not say to another, this is not my father. It's my ancestor was greater than your ancestor. Because if we all descend from Ha'adam, or even Adam and Chava, no one can say my ancestry is better than yours. Because ultimately, all humanity tracks its ancestry back to Adam and Chava. Another reason why humanity was created as an individual is to challenge the heretics. So they should not say, there are many ruling powers in heaven. So unpack that. Why? What's the implication? What does that mean? Why was there one human being created so that the heretics couldn't say there's more than one power in heaven?
Single image of God.
Single image of God. And?
If there were a bunch of them, then they have created a bunch of them.
So the implication is, if there were a bunch of humans created, then someone could say, well, Yerevave created that one, and Isis created that one, and, right? Zeus created that one, right? So, right. If there's one, there's only one deity that created one being. Another reason why humanity was created as an individual is to proclaim the greatness of the KBH, the Kadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy Blessed One. For humans stamp many coins with one seal, and they are all like one another, right? So you take an image and you put it in the hot metal, and the coins all come out identical. But the Holy Blessed One, Sovereign of Sovereigns, has stamped every human with the seal of the first human being, yet no one of them resemble the other exactly. And if perhaps you witnesses should say, why should we be involved with this trouble? Was it not said, they being a witness, whether they have seen or known, and they do not speak it, then they shall bear their iniquity. A verse from Leviticus, meaning, if you witnessed a crime and you are fit to testify, you are obligated to come forward and testify. You don't get to say, I don't want to be implicated in this, right? I'm going to stay home.
See something, say something.
If you see something, say something, particularly if it's murder, right? And if perhaps you witnesses would say, why should we be responsible for the blood of this person? Was it not said, when the wicked perish, there is rejoicing? So it is understood as a value of human society that when murder is punished with capital punishment, this is what the Mishnah is saying, taking a verse of Torah out of context, which is what they do. That's the game. Then when the guilty are punished, that is a good thing. We should feel good that justice has been served, that justice is done. That is good for humanity. That is good for the Jewish people. Yeah. Now, I think we could all agree when justice is done, that is a good thing for society. The argument comes in, what is when justice is done? What is justice, right? So folks who would argue against capital punishment would say, obviously, justice is not done if by you're punishing killing a human being with killing a human being. Like, that makes no sense. Other people would say, okay, then it's life in prison. So then you say, well, why should the community have to pay to keep up this person's life, which is what kind of life anyway, you know, but whatever, but to keep them alive so that the community has to pay, why should the community be burdened? Okay. So that's where the arguments come in, is what is justice? But I think we can all get behind the Torah verse that says, when justice is done, there is rejoicing, and it means in heaven, by the way. It means the great rejoicing is in heaven. God is pleased when justice is done according to God's standards. Now, we would all argue, including Bert, what is God's standards? And that is what takes up a majority of the Talmud, right? Because this is from the Mishnah. Well, what is Talmud? Talmud is the Mishnah with the arguments surrounding it on the page of generations of folks arguing with the Mishnah. Not against the Mishnah, but arguing, what does it mean justice is served? Like, what is justice? And so the Talmud is a bunch of arguments across the generations about the Mishnah. So the Mishnah is in the middle, and all of the arguments are around it. So even Mishnah isn't like, so it's like, okay, we're done. We understand justice is done, and then it's just left to this murky whatever. Oh, no. Then there's lots of arguing about what is justice, what is just. And how do we know? Because if you're going to take constitutional law and apply it to situations that did not exist when the Constitution was written, you can't just go to the Constitution. The Mishnah knows that. So do the rabbis who are trying to adjudicate cases. If it didn't exist, like before CCTV, do you really need two witnesses? Well, do you go to the Constitution? But the Constitution didn't know about CCTV. We're seeing with our own eyes that these two people committed the crime. So you might say, what you need, right, is CCTV footage, clits clear, that goes through facial recognition scanning, and then you can condemn the person. Then what happens? Okay, that's great. We've decided. That's the law. Everyone agrees with it. Everyone's comfortable with it. Everyone's fine. Until what? AI. Until AI. Then comes AI, and how do you know that's not a deep fake? Sure, it's Rabbi Bernstein holding up a guy, but like, how do we know? that that's not a deep fake. And so then there has to be a whole nother conversation about what is just. And then you have to bring different pieces of the Constitution to bear on how do we make that decision, right? And that's how Torah continues to be used throughout the generations as the document that we kind of go back to. But of course, we go back to the Mishnah. Well, the Mishnah's already told us, but, you know, and then we argue from there. So it's never done. The human conversation about what's right, what's wrong is never over. But I did want to bring forward that teaching, that the Bereishit text for our purposes is one that I'm very proud of as the Jewish people, that says God created a single human being, not by accident. It's not like God went, well, let's try and we'll see, right? That it was intentional, says our tradition, that this human being created singly means, and even if you want to go to Adam and Chava, everybody originates from there. So you can't ever say human being X is less human because. You can never say that. You can say they need to be put to death because they did X. You can say they're excommunicated because they did Y. You cannot say fundamentally, you can't say they are less than, less human than you. Not even, by the way, in slaveholding biblical Israel. Slaveholding biblical Israel still saw the slave as fully human. And there were laws about what you could and could not do vis-a-vis a slave. It was not the slave as property and chattel that we have under American law. And when certain people were 5/8, what it was?
3/5.
Three, thank you. 3/5, I'm bad at math. 3/5 a person, there is no such thing in our tradition. I'm not suggesting our tradition is flawless. I'm saying I like these texts that say whatever your argument about how you're treating someone else, it can't be because there's something fundamentally different about who they are. Well, Amalek might be a little different. But again, it's because of what Amalek did. It's not because Amalek is less human. And I think that's an important basis for us to know and really like take in as we start thinking about Jewish ethics and the Jewish ethical approach to what it means to try to figure out how to live together.
So you think that's part of why for men, unless for everyone, it feels very for a Jewish state, treat human lives, seeming.
Yes and no. What did we just say is the reason you can do certain things to other people? It's not because they're less human.
I'm talking about the people in general. You know,
which people?
The Palestinians were not involved with, you know, the innocent bystanders.
So I want to root us in right now, because we're not going to have this conversation. Because it's important to keep raising. What I want to root us in is it's not because they're less human. There is no argument in Israel that says they are by definition less human than we are, therefore. Now, you could say, if they're just as human as you are and created image of God, how come? Okay, that's fine. That's a fair question. Kurtzer asks that question, right? So, or like goes to, what I want to make sure we understand is the answer is never because they are less human than we are. And the answer is always, and we can decide whether we think this is being done or not, the answer is actually the opposite, that the IDF, according to its founding rules and laws, tries to minimize innocent, what we call in the United States, collateral damage. They don't say, because one of you, two of you, 10 of you, 10,000 of you did X, you are all going to be obliterated. That is, so again, we can argue whether or not they're fulfilling their own understanding of their ethical obligations, but built into the IDF's charter, or whatever you call the rules of engagement for a military, built into that is the value, the absolute necessity of protecting innocent human life on the other side. If we look at Nagasaki and Hiroshima, where was that tenant? Make sure you drop evacuation flyers to make sure they're out. I'm not defending what's happening. I'm just saying you can hear how, you know, we claim, you know, and okay. So that is a very, very honest admission, which I so appreciate. This room should be a place where we can do that. I really appreciate that you hold us to a higher standard than what you're seeing unfold. Right. Okay. So, thank you for that. And so that is part of the conversation right now in Israel. Who do we trust is making the decision that exactly what we're doing and the way we're doing it right now is necessary to eliminate Hamas to a place where this can't happen again? That is the question in Israel right now. That is the very heated conversation in Israel right now. Who's making that assessment? And do we trust them? But it's only now that people are able to start really having that conversation. But because before then it was, we have to win this war or we might not exist as a country, right? And that truly is what happened in Israel, whether we agree with it or not or understand it or not. It is absolutely what happened. A lot of people here felt it. Existentially, this was a different moment. And really the country, Micha Goodman has a beautiful podcast on it. I'm happy to send it to you about this feeling that for the first time, his generation understood what other generations did, which is there might not be a Jewish state. Like that landed in a way for his generation that always took the existence of the state of Israel for granted, that, right, it was a very different situation. So, so that was kind of their reality. And now there's starting to be real conversation about who are we trusting with the decision to minimize civilian casualties. And it's not an easy conversation, right? It's not an easy thing. All right. So, read Kurtzer. Please read Kurtzer, because I just think it's a way to start contextualizing some of this in a way, and I know it's long, take a little chunk each night, and by the time we reconvene, you will have read it. I haven't even gotten through all of it yet, because it's it's a lot. So take piece by piece and let that land, then take another piece, let that really land and sit with it for a bit, and then, but it's a really important piece, I think, as is Daniel's, but Daniel's feels like a little more, I mean, in a good way. Like, we should absolutely, yes, yes, and yes. Like, that's how I ended Daniel's, yes, 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 thank God. That's, you know, what's happening in terms of part of the conversation. Department, Kurtzer is like a lot of, it's a lot more. All right, everybody good at home? You good? You with us? All right, everybody. All right. Wonderful to see y'all. I hope to see you next time. We are going to, quote Carol Gilligan next time. So if you want to revisit Gilligan, y'all all know. But those of us who aren't so familiar with Carol Gilligan's work on feminist ethics, just Google her basic argument. It's maybe I should just unpack it a little when we get here.